Hey, so we made history this year at Promax BDA's Station Summit in Las Vegas when three of the most influential people in broadcast journalism shared the same stage for the first time ever. And today, we're excited to share it with you. I'm Kareem Taylor, contributing editor at Promax BDA, and you're listening to the Daily Brief podcast. This engaging episode features David Muir of ABC World News Tonight, Jeff Glor from the CBS Evening News, and Lester Holt of NBC Nightly News, in a panel discussion moderated by Frank Biancuso, Executive Vice President and Group Head of Hearst Television. With the unprecedented changes happening in our world right now, there's never been a more vital time for us to hear their perspectives on the events shaping America today and to find out what it means to be a trusted source in this new minute-by-minute news environment. Let's listen in.
How about this? Not bad, huh? Thank you and good morning, everyone. They say you always remember your first time, right? So with these three on stage and together for the first time, this is going to be memorable not only for them, but for all of us. And I want to just mention it also means a lot that the three of you would join this conference with the industry's top marketing and promotion professionals. Can we give them another round of applause for joining Promax BDA? So everyone is waiting to hear from you, so we're going to jump right in if we can. So I want to start by focusing on some of the big stories dominating the headlines. In this era of nonstop news across all media platforms, it feels like every story, everything is elevated to a fever pitch, right up here, right? So what is the most important story we're covering today? And I'm going to actually start, David, with you. You've got seniority on this group on the Monday through Friday anchor desk, right? You've got 4 years into it, so you get the first question.
That's really frightening.
You're the old man.
You know, I was walking out here, and I said, Lester, I've got your back. And he said, don't push. It's really great to be here with these guys, and thank you for having us this year. And, you know, it's interesting, you talk about this notion that we're at a fever pitch, and we are. And I actually think that that's one of our, you know, main responsibilities at 6:30 is sort of to break through the noise and to really give people at home the bottom line of what really matters after a given day. And we think about the way our lives have changed in this era. The moment you wake up in the morning, you check the headlines on your phone, everybody's getting instant alerts, they're getting, you know, quick tweets during the day of whatever the lead story is. And we've actually seen our audiences grow during this moment. And I think that that tells us that the responsibility is greater for one thing. It tells us that the industry is not a dinosaur, as has been described for many years now. But most importantly, I think that given everything that's hitting people all day long, our job is more important than ever to sort of calm things down. And I try to do that, and I know we all do, sort of in the tone of the newscast itself. The broadcast is very conversational. I hope it's accessible. And, you know, I grew up watching Peter Jennings and was like the only kid in the neighborhood who went inside to watch the news when I was 12, 13 years old. And now I can put words to it. I couldn't then as a kid, obviously. But he was having a conversation with America. And I recognize we're all doing the same thing now. But the conversation is far more of a two-way conversation, just given the power of social media and the fact that our audiences can connect with us in ways that they couldn't connect, even just 5 years ago. So I actually welcome that change.
So, and we're going to talk a little bit about the broadcasts themselves and a little bit of the history in a moment, but we've got a couple of images on screen. I guess I just want to ask you the question, is there one story that really is the most important story we're covering? Look, we got a long range of them.
I will say this. We have a responsibility every night. You have President Trump and Kim Jong-un. We were just talking, the three of us, about going to Singapore and that incredible heat. It's not even Nevada heat, believe it or not. And you've got Robert Mueller there. And so you have these stories that have been heavily politicized, but you have to remember that they are historic moments. And the most important thing that I think we can do as a group and we do in our newsroom every day is to remind ourselves that we are reporting to a divided America and that everyone's voice matters. And so if people at home can find the broadcasts where people on both sides, and I hate even saying both sides because there's a multitude of sides, but if we remember that it is a divided America, it's still divided out there, and people at the end of the day want to make sure that their questions have been asked. And that's sort of what drives our script writing. It drives me when I'm writing the intros to my pieces every night that we do on the broadcast, is that I'm trying to make everyone at home feel welcomed, everyone at home feel as though their question's being asked, and that we recognize that for many people, the stakes are still enormous. You know, it's we have this conception that during a campaign, a presidential campaign, that election day will come and then we can all take a big breather afterward. And that didn't happen. And I think that the country feels that. I think there's half of the country that's still saying, how did this happen? And the other half of the country is saying, you got to give this guy a chance. And as long as we keep that in our heads every day, then we go out there and do that broadcast, that we're the newscast for everyone, and we want them all to feel reflected in the stories that we report, then I do believe that's the best formula in this moment,
all given right.
the story.
So I'm not sure I got an answer to that question, but I'm going to turn it around and I'm going to ask
Well, let me just say, I don't want to dominate the discussion here on this point, but you have a multitude of pictures up there, and I think it shows that there is no one particular story. And I know that...
Okay, and that's a good answer.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
There you go.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I'm going to turn it around. What is the most underreported story that deserves more attention? Lester, I'll throw that to you. You're second in line, 3 years at the Monday through Friday anchor desk, seniority-wise.
Well, I don't know if it's underreported, but I think that, if I can go back to your earlier question, the most important story, I think it's the attack on the justice system. That's the kind of thing that will have potentially a long-reaching impact on our country and the direction of our country if we lose our trust, not only in the justice system, but we lose our trust in journalism. These are important pillars of a functioning democracy. And I think that we can't take this too lightly. Now, underlying all of this is what I call the death of shock. We're not shocked anymore as a country. There are stories that we'll all run to because they're enormous. And within 2 days, no one's talking about them anymore because we are just at a point now that shock happens on a daily basis, that we are no longer shocked. And that's one of the challenges of what we do, is to remind people that, no, we've got to keep talking about this. This is an important topic. But at the same time, the bell is ringing so many different places that we have to respond to. But I think it affects everything that we do. Some of the mass shootings that we've reported, they follow a familiar path right now. You know, this horrible shock, and we're all there. And then within a couple of days, the conversation has shifted. Parkland was unique in that it kept the nation's attention. That's partly because of the activism of the students. But, you know, we're not talking about what happened in Santa Fe, Texas, just a few weeks ago. We're not even talking about what happened down the street here less than a year ago. So it certainly affects the public, but it affects our ability to tell these stories, that keeping people's attention.
Well, let me ask this, because you talked about the amount of time these stories will run. So how does the 24-hour cable and digital news cycle play into all this? This constant need to fill time, does this help or does it hurt journalism? And Jeff, you're going to get the question. You're 7 months in with your seniority here. You've got CBSN, your 24-hour news service, obviously. We have MSNBC. We got a lot out there. Does it help or hurt journalism with this constant 24-hour need to fill time?
I don't know if it helps. I think it could help if they're having thoughtful, smart conversations. I'm not sure that always takes place. And so, our goal every night, because we're not beholden to talking about it all day long, is to curate that news and to have these discussions, to have the smartest, best, most concise discussion at the end of the night. If people want to watch cable news during the day, go for it. You certainly can find any thoughts, opinions you want on television all day long, every day. I think that's okay if people don't want to watch that. I think in some ways it's unfortunate if you're only getting one point of view, and I think what we're trying to do is just get to the truth. Okay. And be as fair as possible.
All right, well, that was a good warm-up. We got a lot of issues to get through, so we're going to try to get through as many of them as we can. I'm going to move on to the president. President Trump has dominated the news cycle ever since he rode down the escalator and announced his candidacy. From the beginning, though, there have been studies that say much of the Trump coverage, including on the broadcast networks, is negative. A recent MRC study said 90% negative. So I'm going to ask a very simple question. Generally speaking, does the press provide balanced coverage of the Trump administration for any of you?
I think yes. I think in general. I mean, anytime we use the term press or media, I'm always like, you know, that's a very, very broad definition. But I think among the mainstream media, and I say that proudly being a member of the mainstream media, I think we have been fair. We have to call out the unusual. And there has been a lot of unusual. We have to call out the challenge to the notion of objective truth. you know, if that lies, if that's perceived as negative, so be it, but we can't ignore these stories. We don't have the luxury of being numb to these stories as much as the public has that luxury, but we don't. These are important changes. These are things that we've never witnessed before. That's what news does, exposes these sorts of things. We can do it without a sense of arrogance, without a sense of smugness, with just a sober look at it, but it's incumbent on us that we have to point out some of these things you're seeing are not the usual.
But I think it's also important to remember that this is not the first time the press has been criticized. It won't be the last. It's sort of the lowest hanging fruit for folks to go after. So the notion that we have to change what we do because of any particular administration, I'm not sure that's right. We are going to keep doing what we're doing. Listen, if you have an agenda, you don't belong in this business. We're not trying to promote an agenda one way or the other. We're trying to do the best newscast we can every night.
Well, let me ask this. In his first year, the president held fewer solo press conferences than his predecessors. Actually, just one. President Obama held 11 solo press conferences in his first year, 12 for Clinton, 5 for Bush. The White House says he's making himself more available through these, impromptu Q&A, and obviously by tweeting. So, David, I'll ask you in this case, does the press have enough access, or maybe the right access, to President Trump?
Yeah, honestly, I'll say that President Trump does make himself available. I mean, it's not, in traditional terms, the solo press conference like we saw in Singapore. That was a long press conference. But he does make himself available, particularly when he wants to make himself available. He'll walk out, in front of where the White House correspondents do their live shots every night, and he'll do an impromptu, gaggle where we'll get, and he stands there for quite some time. So he does take, the tough questions on any particular issue. Obviously we would like more, and we would like a greater opportunity to sort of interact with the president. We always do. I think that's always the challenge. It was the challenge with the previous administration, sitting down with President Obama and knowing you had 15 minutes firm and hoping that if you ended up with 21, 22, you had a good day sitting across from him. But I do think that we get access to President Trump. I will say this, though, and this goes back to the actual election itself and the campaign. I sensed that in this country, it is almost as though Americans were binge viewing the campaign like a Netflix series, that every day was a new episode of this campaign. And I think there is, there are a few laughs in the room, and I think it's entertaining to watch it that way, but there are some inherent dangers in that I think that if you start with sort of the third debate, and then you had around that time, right beforehand, the Access Hollywood tape, and then the final 11 days you had the James Comey email investigation suddenly front and center again, and then maybe a day and a half before the election saying there's nothing there. And when you have a country that's sort of watching the daily episodes, it's our job more than ever to sort of help with the bigger picture of the stakes, really, on both sides. And so when you ask now, do we get enough time with President Trump? We get his tweets, we get his moments, when he comes out before the cameras, we get the one solo press conference that he just did last week, that we have to use that time wisely. And I think that the White House press corps has been tough, and I'm proud of the work that they've done. And you've asked have we been too tough? I think, again, the guiding principle for me and our team every day is just simply ask the questions that people would want asked at home, and then generally you're pretty safe out there. And you have to remember that in asking those questions, half the country is saying, give the guy a break, let us see what he can do, and the other half saying you've got to hold this administration accountable. And so you really have to do both, because the audience will expect it.
Well, we can't not talk about fake news when it comes to the president, obviously. The term, by the way, added to the dictionaries last fall. We all know the president uses the term for what he perceives as false stories, or perhaps stories that he doesn't agree with. And returning from Singapore, he called out CNN and NBC, tweeting, "Our country's biggest enemy is fake news." So I guess what I would say is, from an image standpoint, how concerned are you and the networks about this label? And since I brought up NBC, Lester, I'll ask you this question.
Well, I mean, he's used it to great effect, as he, President Trump has been very effective at, those he considers his adversaries, giving them a pet name, in our case, fake news. I mean, a couple things about that. I don't think you can tweet away or insult away the years of integrity and trust that were built by these three organizations. So, I don't think we're in danger on that level. It's not helpful, And it gets back to my earlier answer about, you know, attacking, you know, institutions that are important to our democracy, and certainly a free and independent press is very important. I laugh on some level to the idea of fake news, because there is such a thing as fake news. You know, an alien just landed on Vegas Boulevard. That's fake news. There is inaccurate news. There's sloppy news. And it's incumbent on all of us to call that out. When we don't reach the bar we want to, we have to be transparent about it. So that's an issue.
Well, right or wrong, though, there's a certain portion of the audience that believes this. There just is. And I would tell you, you know, to your point about mistakes happen, last week, Trump tweeted, look at the fake news ABC put out. He had taken a mistaken graphic that was put on there. It was an honest mistake. It said Paul Manafort pleads guilty to 5 counts of manslaughter. And he used that, you know, for his narrative. And it makes it challenging. And I guess I can't believe that there's not discussion about the image implications at the networks.
I think it is important sometimes to draw the distinction between what's important and what's interesting. So the tweets are often interesting. I'm not sure how important they are. And so the theatrics that can be provided can be interesting to look at, but when we're talking about what we put into the broadcast every night, we try to put all of that in some perspective. And again, keeping in mind, it's not the first time the press will be criticized. It's not the last. As far as the tweets go, I think that's something that's important to keep in mind.
I'm going to stay with you just for a moment because two of you reported out of Los Angeles yesterday, but you had a special report that actually is relevant to my next question from last night. Are the fake news claims, along with this era of political anger and in some cases really violent rhetoric, creating a dangerous environment for both the politicians and the journalists?
Sure, in some cases I think that might be right, but I think it's also, I think that folks on either extreme are always going to be the loudest, and that's okay. They can speak out and say what they believe. I think there's a more nuanced, balanced, reasonable part of the American public that doesn't always get all that attention. We see sort of the insane comments online, on Twitter, on other places, and think that's America. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that.
Well, I mean, these are very real things that happened. We had, of course, reported over the weekend, Sarah Sanders and her family pushed out of a restaurant. Secretary Nielsen confronted Steve Scalise, obviously, last year. We had a man arrested going after some CNN employees, saying it was because of fake news. And then we had Congresswoman Maxine Waters really encouraging this kind of activity, which has been in the news the last day or so. So I guess...
Fair enough.
Your answer is what? You don't have a concern about that?
This is exactly what we talked about with our focus group, the California voters, last night. We had a wide range of voters, ethnically, demographically, economically, politically. They're concerned about it. I don't think they want to see that. I think there is an interest from possibly more people than you think to tone down some levels of the conversation and have that more reasonable discussion. I think it's possible. I think it's done. I think us talking about how crazy things are sometimes just makes things more crazy, right? I think it's
Did
why
you
we
just call me crazy.
Yeah, no, it's why we had this discussion last night with the focus group. It's why we're going to have focus more of that tonight.
Who went to the correspondents' dinner in D.C.?
I haven't gone for the last several years, actually.
All right. Well, let me ask this question. Speaking of supercharged language, sort of an out of left field question, has political humor gone too far? You got the correspondents' dinner, you got the late night shows, you got Samantha Bee, you got Kathy Griffin. Just a yes or no, you don't have to elaborate if you don't want to.
Listen, I think there, and I don't think it's just comedy, I think that there are unforced errors really on all sides. For the political parties in Washington, I think there are unforced errors. I think in the world of comedy, we should have a healthy dialogue, and comedy is. For many, many years has been sort of a release for this country, a sort of reprieve from the heaviness of the moment. And we have seen little hints of it where perhaps it actually elevated the temperature instead of bringing the temperature down and allowing us to laugh it off. And I think that at times can be an unforced error. I will say this about the rhetoric that you were asking Jeff about and whether or not it's dangerous. I think it can be, but I also think it's important for all of us up here on the stage and in this room, because you work at local stations all over the country, obviously, is to remember the vast majority of Americans are not tweeting angry tweets or lashing out. You know, there are a select few, I think, who feel very strongly, and we should value their opinions, but we shouldn't let it dictate what we cover and dictate our own conversation. I was saying earlier, one of our responsibilities is to bring the temperature down at 6:30 and to have a level-headed discourse and ask the questions, as I said, that everyone at home wants asked. And, you know, it's funny. After the election, there were a lot of these discussions around the country about East Coast elite, West Coast elite, should we be out in the country more? And I was thinking to myself, you know, why are we having these conversations now? You know, I'm a kid from upstate New York who wrote to the local news guy when I was 12 or 13 years old, blue collar roots. I'm not an East Coast elite. And we all have different series on our broadcasts. I've been doing Made in America for 7 years now, where we travel to factories and towns all over the country. And, you know, it's not our job to tell these campaigns, but had they called me up, I would have said issue number one is jobs in this country. And the second prevailing issue for every family that I've interviewed in this country is that they just want their kids and their grandkids to have a slightly better lot in life than they had. And again, those are the prevailing notions of most people in America. And I think that if you signal in our broadcast, as we try to do, particularly at the end of the broadcast, that we're sort of all in this together, we'll, it's overwhelming at times, but we're all in this together and we'll tackle it again tomorrow, is the only way to sort of bring down the temperature in the room and across, you know, not only the comedy spectrum, but across the level of discourse in this country.
Okay, but I'm going to get a yes or no answer from you. Has it gone too far or not?
Well, I will
yes
say
no.
There have been unforced errors, and I don't think that
helps. That's yes. That's a yes.
Yeah,
for you.
I would say.
Okay,
if you have a political standpoint, like some. My whole point is, you know, but I won't be trapped either, so I hear you all laughing.
Well, no, you know what?
I won't be trapped into a soundbite.
Let me tell you, though. It's not a trap question. Because this is all connected together. We don't have what's going on with the restaurants over here, and then political humor is something over there,
The bottom line is, I think there are sound ways to make points, and I think humor is a really valuable way for us to let off some steam at this moment in time. But I also think there's a tremendous pitfall of sort of the unforced error we've seen in the campaigns. And
it's
I think
a fair answer. Fair answer. Lester?
I will make the distinction. I don't think comedy, I'm not going to judge comedy. I don't think it's gone too far. Comedy is comedy, and some comedy is very biting. Where I draw the distinction, I don't think that we as journalists should be embracing the comedy. You talked about the
well, course. How can you say that when the evening shows and the morning shows will periodically show a clip? I mean, CBS This Morning, Good Morning America, to the Today Show, there's clips in the morning from these shows, so you can't say we don't really connect to that. We do. It's in the news programs.
We don't run them on my broadcast, but I think that, you look back to every administration.
Next time you run one of those, man, I'm sending emails. Okay. Let me tell you.
We run them sometimes, certainly in context of a particular
story,
but we don't run them gratuitously. But I do think that, you know, comedy has always been biting. You go back to Nixon, you can look at any administration, and comedians have a field day with administrations.
Yep. Yes, there are times when we will put comedy clips as part of a piece. But I don't think CBS This Morning does it gratuitously. I think that's carefully sort of curated and watched, and it's part of the show. I mean, these shows have a rhythm. So as far as the White House Correspondents' Dinner goes, I mean, comedians are comedians. They're supposed to say outrageous things. Did I find it particularly funny? Not necessarily, but that's okay. You know.
All right, boy, this was a side question. It ended up being a great question.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna change gears here. I want to talk about really the changing role of the network newscast. When you think back to some of the pioneers and icons of network TV news, their 30-minute nightly newscast really defined the times and the industry. There they are, some of them right there. But they didn't have to deal with the competitive pressures of 24/7 cable news, platforms,
media. You need Diane Sawyer up here. There's too many men up here.
Really?
Fix this graphic of the...
You know what, David?
Yeah.
Hold that thought for about 5 minutes. We're going to talk about that subject. But I guess I'll throw out, how do you keep a 30-minute evening newscast relevant in today's environment? And by the way, it's not 30 minutes. It's 20 and a half minutes minus commercials. Since Walter Cronkite probably was the biggest presence on that page, I'm going to start with you.
I think it's 22. 21 and a half. What is it now? Yeah.
My graphic department says 20 and a half for the record.
How do you keep it relevant? I mean, we have discussions and intense dialogue all day long, deciding what's going to be in the broadcast every single night. It's a lot of hard work, but it's a great challenge, and it's a lot of fun having these discussions. And so are we sometimes changing things very late? Yes. But when we launch things early in the morning, we hope that if we talk about something enough, that we get to a level where we can provide more of those layers and more of the depth than you're going to get in some other outlets, in some other places.
Okay, and you know, it's interesting. In the 60s, 90% of the TVs watched one of the evening newscasts, which really is just quite remarkable in general. You've all certainly been recognized for the product. We've got National Murals down the row here. David, your broadcast, Best Newscast, Breaking News, CBS, Overall Excellence in general. What are your thoughts on this, David?
Well, I mean, I'm grateful for the award. I think ultimately, though, the audience decides. And you know, you talk about 21, 22 minutes, whatever it is. I was struck. I was home last weekend, upstate New York, for my nephew's graduation. And I had a couple of people come up to me and say, you know, I wouldn't watch the news right now if you weren't on it. And I don't say that to pat myself on the back because it's my hometown. I hope they're watching. But what they were saying was they're just exhausted. They're exhausted by the times that we're in. And I had that from a couple of different people, and I know that they would offer, you know, Lester and Jeff the same message, and that to me tells me that our job is more important than ever, that if we do have 21 or 22 minutes and they are still coming to us, then we have to really cut through the noise for them, because for many people that still is just the sole source or the most important source during the day. They might watch the cables at night, and I think the cables actually bring valuable discussion. I think that the danger in the cables is if you have the far left, the far right, if you only go to the place where you're going to hear your thoughts back to yourself, that can be a little dangerous. But I think if you take it all in, that's the healthiest.
Well, let me ask to that point. Yeah. So you've got a combined 24 million viewers between the three of you. And by the way, during that time period, cable has 4.5 million. So with all the buzz we hear about cable, the dominant footprint, the dominant voice is with the big three broadcasts in general. But when viewers strengthen their allegiance, yes, absolutely. But when viewers strengthen their allegiance with Fox News on the right, as you said, and MSNBC on the left, how do you hold viewers? I don't want to say and differentiate your programs, but how do you hold viewers? Lester, I'll throw this to you.
You do original content. I mean, what you're talking about when you show those faces, that was a time when people sat down to find out what the news was. Most of you, when you tune us in tonight, you already know what the major headlines. You got them on your phone. You saw them in the back of a taxi. So it's about original content. You know, when I'm doing the news, I've got monitors there. I can see what you guys are doing. And a lot of times we're matching story to story.
You watch
story.
Us?
I do watch you. I do a commercial break, I'll sit down. But often we're going story to story in those first three or four stories of the broadcast. But where we distinguish ourselves is original content. At NBC News, you know, we have put an enormous amount of resources on beefing up our investigative units, our health, our consumer science, social, you know, coverage of social media and digital issues, because those are the stories that are going to differentiate us. You know, when there's a mass shooting or, you know, a big political story of the night, we're all going to be doing it. We're going to be doing it probably in a similar fashion, and putting a lot of resources. But it's that added value that makes the difference. That's what distinguishes, you know, the three broadcasts, what we bring to the table that's not necessarily on your phone that night. I will just add another point in this overall discussion. For the first time in my career, people are coming up and thanking me for being, not just, hey, we recognize you on TV, but thank you for being a journalist. Thank you for asking the important questions. Thank you for being there for us. That's extraordinary. I've been doing this now for 37 years, and never in my life have I seen that kind of reaction. So audiences are engaged. They have an expectation from us. They know it's a short amount of time every day, but they understand that we have to curate this broadcast. And to David's point, the last part of the broadcast is becoming the most popular. One of the things people come to me, they say, thank you for those stories that kind of, you know, that kind of reaffirm our worldview, that we're okay. We tell stories that aren't political, about people doing enormous things on their own in their communities, and people off. I had a flight attendant the other day come up to me. She was almost in tears. She goes, "Oh my God, those stories you guys do at the end, they make me cry every time. And thank you, but thank you for doing them because it, you know, it makes me feel good about what are otherwise uncertain."
Well, they really resonate now about this moment. I mean, I think they always have, but there is something going on there. Yeah.
Well, one of the ways you're trying to differentiate yourself is by field anchoring these big stories, obviously, right? And you're all traveling a lot. You were all in Singapore. There are a couple of images right there. Let me just ask you generally, I think a lot of us are interested, what's the criteria for determining where and when to go somewhere?
I don't think there's any set criteria. And I will say this, you had some of the greats up there behind us, and that sort of looms large. And when I had the opportunity to do the job that I'm in now, one of the first things I did, and it was great, was fun for me anyway, is to go through the archives and select images of Peter, Charlie, Diane, and we put them up in the hallway down to the newsroom so that everybody walking in every day remembers sort of the giants and the standards that have been set before us. But one of the things in getting there in time to report for Peter and then Charlie and Diane is that I felt lucky enough to be the guy that they sent all over the world, sort of, you know, the globe trotting, you know, wherever the hotspot is. And I did that for more than a decade for ABC. And so when I got the anchor job, one of the things that part of the discussion with the bosses was, we're going to keep doing this, you know, and I'll just take the show out there. And it has become the DNA, really, for our broadcast, and I know their broadcasts as well, is that we do go out, and I don't think there's any set rule. I think there is an expectation now, because we've set the bar, all three of us, in being willing to, you know, travel at a moment's notice. You know, I know there's probably a little bit of questioning behind the scenes here today. Would there be something that happens that takes us out of the mix from this, you know, from this discussion? I'm glad that we're all here.
We have 14 minutes left. Yeah. They took my phone away.
Don't watch the phone.
I will say, though, that, you know, we're all reporters. My background is as a reporter. The most exciting, interesting moments in my career have not been sitting behind a glass desk. They have been in the field. Our criteria often is, can we elevate the story by my presence? Can I leverage an interview that we might not otherwise get because I'm on the ground? You know, we took the broadcast to McAllen, Texas last Monday because that story had kind of blown up over the weekend with the Sunday talk shows. It was an important story. My presence there hopefully elevated the discussion that this is something we need to talk about as a country because we're facing this confluence of the, you know, the notion that, you know, we honor and respect our sovereignty as a country, but we're also a country of big hearts. And so that was an opportunity to really kind of frame this larger discussion. But I think probably I can speak for all of us. We're all more comfortable in the field.
So let me ask you this. Jeff, do you ever draw the line of where you will or won't go? Will you say, I'm not doing that?
No.
Have you ever said no?
Off the top of my head, I can't. I think they wanted me to parachute out of a plane once, but that was a
okay.
Another, right. Another show.
Up on that, I'll do it again.
I will say that you do have to ask yourself questions, though, about the moment in time that we're in. And I never want to appear, and it's not this particular story or anything we mentioned on this stage, but there is one question I always ask myself, and that is, do we look like we're injecting ourselves into the political discourse? And that's sort of the balancing act that you have to play because you don't want to ratchet up what we talked about earlier, sort of the maybe sort of the fringe on the left or the fringe on the right and sort of elevate the fire that's behind some of their tweets or some of their anger. And so, you know, especially when we go into these communities where there has been, you know, lives lost, the other thing that I always think about is we get to leave after a couple of days, and long after we leave, their suffering continues, and their efforts to rebuild their communities continues. And I always say it's important to signal to our audience that we recognize that we parachute in and then leave and go back to our lives, and it's really important to update those stories along the way. And no matter which broadcast you're watching, you'll remember that moment with Jeff and someone, or Lester and someone, or a moment when I was here in Vegas and walked into a hospital room with a young woman and a young man and their parents around them after the Las Vegas massacre. And I always remember their faces. And, you know, before we came out here today, I said, let's reach out and find out where they are right now and how they're doing in their lives. And our audience, I do think, appreciates that. And you know, we all make these calculations day to day when it comes to building the newscast. Most of us will go out the door at a moment's notice, but there are questions that you have to ask about the people who are so vulnerable in these moments and who are willing to share with you their stories. But then if they're going to do that, then you have to invest in them over the long haul. I think that's the only way to do it.
So, excellent. So with the clock ticking, I want to get to several other
lightning
round issues. And you gave me the great lead-in for it. So I want you to take a look at the next graphic that we're going to put up here. All right? These are the only women to have anchored or co-anchored a weeknight newscast on the big three broadcast networks, mostly short-lived stints, okay? So understanding that the three of you are not in charge of hiring, and we don't want the three of you off your broadcast, I want to ask a simple question. Jeff, I'll start with you. Why haven't we seen more women on the weeknight big three broadcasts?
That's a good question. I'd like to think it's a coincidence that there's just three guys sitting up here. I'm also not a woman, so I can't pretend to know what they feel seeing that. I can't. I will say that at CBS, it's the work that matters, not the gender. And as long as we're talking about women, the women that I work with every day are incredible. We have an extraordinary group of anchors, correspondents, producers. So that's who I work with every day, and I'm honored to do that.
Well, I'm going to ask another question here, Lester. Let me put it this way. How do you and the networks ensure that the female voice and perspective is represented in editorial content?
Well, the people you hire, obviously, our editorial meetings and the number of, you know, women we have in prominent roles. But I want to go back to your question, because a lot of people ask me about being, you know, the first solo African-American anchor of a broadcast. And I always said it this way. There's only three of these jobs, and they don't come open very often. In my case, it came, you know, very suddenly. There was no sign that said, you know, black people need not apply for these jobs, because there just weren't many of them. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. But to your other question, it's making sure that we have a diversity in the conversation. We call it the RIM. I think everyone has a different name for it, but it's that main group of executive and senior producers who, you know, define the broadcast every night, and making sure that we have voices that represent the audience that we serve. I think it's incredibly important, and I say this all the time, that people should be able to turn on the television, and especially kids, and see people that may look like them or look like their neighbor, that look like the country that they live in. We want our broadcast to reflect this nation and not look like, you know, we're, you know, from some unique elite place. But it's about making sure that you have those voices in the conversation. It's not a democracy what we do, but it is a collaborative effort every night.
I want to challenge each other. Let me move on, though. I want to stay with the topic of women in the industry for a moment. I'm going to direct this question to you, David. Like many businesses, the TV industry has not been immune to the issues that led up to the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. right? So let me ask this. When it comes to stories that touch our industry, or our companies, all of our companies, how do we ensure that the media covers them fairly and transparently?
Just well, I would actually question. Say there probably is an even added effort when it involves our own industry. I'm sure in the other two newsrooms as well, and in the other news organizations, I think that when our own industry is under the spotlight and the scrutiny is on some of our colleagues, that there probably is an added effort to make sure people at home know that we are asking the tough questions when it comes to whoever it is who's in the headlines at that moment. And we saw a lot of that during this, and this is not a movement that's going away. And so I hope that you have seen that at your local stations as well. Before you move on from those wonderful five women you have up there, because you had incredible women up there, I just felt lucky when I was looking at that, because all five of them I'm friends with, I've learned from all five of them, and I hope that we can one day get to a place, you know, this term trailblazer becomes so cliche, but all of those women are trailblazers. I saw Barbara at one end and Diane at the other, and I don't think they're trailblazers just for women. That's the really key thing here. I've learned so much from Diane Sawyer, and I'm grateful for everything that she's taught me in friendship and in the business, and it's an honor to be in a chair. That's why I was saying earlier, it's a real honor to be in the chair after Diane Sawyer, and to have that phone call from her when that transition happened, saying the time is yours. So I think it's really important to let those women know that they've had an impact on us men, and in very, very strong and impactful ways, in the way that they've taught us how to do some of their own kinds of storytelling in ways that hadn't been done before.
Lester, Jeff, you want to comment on that question?
I think that probably, well, first of all, I'm trying to think back. I don't recall any conversation that suggested that we would cover it any differently. In fact, the only conversation was that this is a story that we will cover even when it impacts closer to home than we like.
It does, but I think what goes on in newsrooms is when something like this happens or any story involving people who work for the newsroom, you do X-rated more, and you X-ray it more because you say, we've got to absolutely make sure we approach this.
And that's my point, is that I think there, if anything, you know, you probably, your tendency is to be even more aggressive on
the
story. I don't know if that was the case, but I mean, I do know that we didn't flinch, that these stories, whether they were hitting close to home or hitting, you know, at a competing network, we knew that we had to cover it aggressively and independently. That, you know, working on you know, the companies are working on their own track, but as journalists, we had to work solely on getting the story right.
I trust our standards and our values, and I believe that our team gets it right, and we cover so many different stories, and they are rigorous, they are detailed, they are vigilant, and whether it's this story or another one, I trust them.
Well, an important topic. I appreciate your comments on that. Now we're going to really change gears for a moment. All three of you are engaged with social media, right? These are some photos we lifted off of your Instagram account, actually. David with your mother on Mother's Day, I think. Lester, Father's Day with your new grandson, two boys. And then a great holiday shot, Jeff, with your family.
I want to take a picture of that now and send it to my son. He'll be thrilled.
You do that.
I'm famous. Definitely.
So here's the general question. Is social media something you enjoy, or is it a necessary evil for your job? A lot of us spend a lot of time, A, trying to get our talent to do it, B, trying to get them to do it correctly, and then C, trying to figure out why they don't have as many followers as they should have. So, right? So, I mean, it's really a couple of fast questions I want to get at here, but enjoy it or necessary evil?
It's fine. I mean, it's never been something that I've necessarily sought out. Or that's been like the main focus for me. I'll do it. I never felt compelled to post or tweet or anything else. I'll do it when I think it's interesting. I'll put up pictures. It's a lot of times it's so family can see it, so I'm not on a text chain with 80 different people. But yeah, it's fine, you know. And I hope that people.
I'm sure David Rose will be glad to hear that you are doing this for your family.
No. Instagram or Facebook to a certain extent. Right. The tweeting, I think, is more industry-focused, right? Okay? So, and I think that's more news-related. I've never had any conversations with them saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to be doing this more, you need to pick up your followers. And I've never felt compelled to post or tweet.
Lester, I think joy or necessary evil?
You know, somewhere in the middle. We obviously like to promote our programming, our stories, and it's a great tool for that. I think it's a generational thing for people my age. We're not used to sharing as much personally. You know, I shared that particular photo, but I'm a little guarded sometimes about, you know, personal. I also, it's not fun sometimes wading in because the, you know, you can, there's days you can tweet something, it's a beautiful day in Las Vegas, and someone will tweet back, through your liberal rose-colored glasses. I mean, the conversation...
It's like, you're like, you know, what does that have to do?
The conversation devolves very quickly. So I wade into it, you know, mostly it's a promotional vehicle.
Well, I'm not going to let David answer because, A, he doesn't know how to give a yes or no answer. That's number one. But, B, I don't want to embarrass anyone because you've got the most followers, really, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I know you enjoy it because I see what you're doing with it. You do enjoy it, I assume.
Yeah, I do. And I think that, you know, the old school, when social media first came on the scene, the old school formula, I think, for a lot of the stations in this room was, you know, I'm doing this story today. Join us for more on, you know, News Center 5 at 6. And I think that that's become sort of an antiquated model. I think that the power in social media is connecting with the audience. It's like what I said earlier. Peter Jennings had this great conversation with America. But I recognize today that that conversation goes both ways. And the only reason I do social media now and then is to let people know at home that it's that same notion that, you know, we've got many of the same likes, desires, hopes, and dreams for our families and in our communities. And so I just do snapshots. I mean, who doesn't love their mom? Mm-hmm. So I just put my mom up on my
I have to tell you, I read a lot of the people responding to your posts. I've never seen so many comments about great hair, ever. Yeah. In there. So anyway, so I've got two other issues I want to get at in the remaining time that we have, a couple of final topics here. Looking at the future of our industry, how do we attract and inspire the next generation of journalists, news managers, marketers. Lester, you're actually growing your own. Your son is co-anchor at WNBC, and as we talked about, I'm proud. Our station in West Palm Beach, right. Put him on the anchor desk first.
I think mentorship is so important. I'm a product of people in the newsrooms who took the time to admonish me, to help me, to encourage me. I think sometimes, especially in the era we're in now, where everything becomes a clip, that we don't give young people a chance sometimes to excel. We have to keep reminding them that this is still a noble profession. What we do is important, and we have to support them. I hate the fact that, when I was coming up in the business, I mean, I did some real doozies on the air, but I didn't have to have people click them on over and over and over again and mock me. And now that's the world that that young reporters are coming up in now. So I think that there's great value in recognizing talent and potential, and I think that if this business is going to continue to thrive, we have to be there. We have to lend our ear, lend our support to young people, and encourage them to kind of carry the ball.
I always say, that anchor in Syracuse responded to me. I used to run out to the mailbox during summer break, and I finally got the letter from him, and I'm sure he regretted it at the time because I showed up at 13 and never left that newsroom. So anyone who writes to me at ABC or tweets me asking to come in, we have sort of a glass hallway above the set, and every night there are faces in that glass wall looking down on the set, and they come down afterwards because I always just sort of feel that when you make it through that door, you've got to turn around and offer a hand to the next people who want to come after you. And I always say the same thing to them, this chair is yours. Not in the next maybe year or two, but give me a little time. But I think it's really important because there are a lot of people, particularly in this moment in our country, who do want to do important journalism, and we need them.
I have one final question because it says your time is up, but I'm still going to ask the question. It's a good final question, and I'll start with you. What do you most admire about the men on this stage?
Their commitment to their jobs, to putting something on every night that I know is thoughtful and that has been discussed for a long, long time. And like this is, you talk about the travel involved, and you talk about the commitment involved. I mean, they've all made the commit. They've made the commitment too. And as Lester said, it's a small group. It's three people, And so I think there is a kinship there. There's an understanding of who's come before us, and as David said, who will come after us. And so I hope that we just all do a really good job keeping those seats warm in the meantime.
I think that our shared belief in our newscasts, the way we tell stories, our storytelling. I think it's the commitment to the art, understanding that this is these are important broadcasts, and understanding that we still serve a vital role. I think we all grew up, watching these programs, and now to be, the faces of them and an integral part of them, it's a huge responsibility. I think that understanding, that shared sense of responsibility, I think is admirable, and I think we're all very, very fortunate to do
it. So, David, what do you most admire about the two gentlemen?
About both of these guys and you. We do have monitors in the desk. We joked about this earlier, and
so you do watch me. I knew it.
I actually wait to go on at 7. No, but I put the lineup oftentimes over the monitors because I just feel like the team has to own what our choices are when we come out of the gate. But I have heard in the past from some of our colleagues, I don't watch what the other guy's doing, and I think, or other gal's doing, and I think that's silly. I have huge respect for both of these guys and their entire teams. These broadcasts do great original programming, both of them, and so does ours. And, I am a fan of journalists at all the networks, and you talk about social media, and I follow people from each of the networks and some of the cables as well. And I often go home, and the day doesn't end, unfortunately, because I get sucked into the discourse that continues long into the evening hours. But I have a profound respect for not only what the gentlemen on the stage do, but for what their team does, because I know what it takes to get the broadcast on the air every night. It's a beast of a broadcast. I know what all of you do in your local stations. I'm a product of local news. I know that you're doing more with less, and I know that it's a real partnership with all of you, and I'm grateful. I know Lester and Jeff are. I'm grateful for the partnership that you guys have helped build in this moment in time, and to see our audience grow at 6:30. And this is not a pat on the back. It's the biggest audience since Jennings 22 years ago. and they had Oprah at the time leading in. So that says something about this moment for Jeff, Lester, and me, and everybody in this room. People are hungry for news. They're hungry for an elevated discussion. They're hungry for us to take the temperature down and ask the questions they want to ask. And that should be our guiding principle, and the viewers will come. They already have. It's not dying at all.
So as advertised, a first-time gathering of this powerhouse panel. Thank you, David, Lester, Jeff. I also want to thank Promax BDA. I want to thank Promax BDA for inviting me back to moderate the panel. It ain't going to get much better than this. I'm proud to have represented Hearst TV. And of course, remember, you can follow us all on social media. Have a great day. Enjoy the sessions.
Thank you.
Excellent. Appreciate it.
It was fun. That was great.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. Kareem Taylor produced this episode. Video helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate Lekire-Marion contributes to Daily Brief. Follow Promax BDA on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media platforms at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.